Hello, everyone, and welcome to our Fundraising Masters for August. Wow, it's almost the end of the summer. Today, we're talking about the happy, healthy nonprofit strategies for impact without burnout. And as you know, I have Beth Cantor here, and I'm going to introduce her in a minute. I'm Brian Saber, president of ASCII Matters. I'm really delighted to have you here. And I'm very excited by this topic because it is so important to us, especially in fundraising, and especially for those of us who are frontline fundraisers and out there with the donors all the time. And as many of you know, here at Asking Matters, we are uber focused on face-to-face asking, and that is not easy. As I have said all my career, it's not easy. It's not necessarily fun. It's rewarding. It makes our nonprofits run. It gives them the resources they need. We do it. We care, but it's challenging and we can get burnt out. So I'm delighted you're here along with me to learn from Beth about keeping our nonprofits and ourselves healthy. I'm speaking to you from South Orange, New Jersey, where I live and work. And to make sure you know where the questions box I'm going to ask you to type in where you're listening in from today. In case you haven't found that yet, hopefully on the left you're seeing my slide and on the right the control panel. If not, click on that orange and white arrow to expand it. Two things to be aware of there. One, the questions box. I see many of you have found it. And two, audio. Often audio issues are on your end. Once in a while, they're on ours. Beth and I were just comparing horror stories before we got on. But generally, it's on your end. And if you toggle to phone call, you'll get a telephone number and you can call in and listen that way, because most of us today are listening in on our computers. And welcome to everyone from clear across the country and from Canada. We have hundreds of you with us today, and I'm delighted by that, and it shows how important a topic this is. You will be getting a link to slides. I think Beth's also going to offer some bonus materials and a link to the recording. All of that will come to you tomorrow with a follow-up to today's webinar. So without further ado, I want to introduce Beth, who is a fundraising master and a master trainer, speaker, author, blogger. She's got a fantastic presence online, a massive Twitter audience, which I am very much in awe of, and has been a thought leader in our field for a long time. And I'm really delighted, Beth, that I finally got you on my Fundraising Master Series. I feel like it's been a couple of years I've been hoping, and it finally worked out. So I'm delighted you are with me today. Thank you.
Great. Great. Thanks for inviting me. I'm thrilled to be here, and I hope my sound is working.
It is. Your sound is working perfectly, and I've just given you the control so you can launch your screen. There you go.
Great.
And you can take it from here.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Brian. And I'm a little bit relieved that everything's working. Brian and I were just chatting about webinar horror stories, so hopefully we won't have any of those
exactly.
problems. And if they do, well, you know, that happens, and we have a plan. We have a plan B. And so Brian gave me a great introduction. You know, in addition to that, I've written a couple of books, and The Network Nonprofit and Measuring the Network Nonprofit. Those are more around digital strategy and digital fundraising, but I also do a lot around leadership development. And that's the topic of today's webinar, is based on my most recent book, The Happy, Healthy Nonprofit Strategies for Impact Without Burnout. So so what we're going to do right off the bat is we're going to do an audience poll to get a sense of how your organization looks at well-being in the workplace. And I'm going to be launching the poll that I just learned how to do. And hopefully I'm going to do it correctly.
Yes.
All right, I clicked the button.
There it
oh,
is.
Water.
You did.
And
excellent.
And I still see my slides. So,
yes. Great. So, yes, if everyone could click. We'll give you maybe 20 seconds to figure out, you know, what to learn what your nonprofit's experience with well-being in the workplace is. If you discuss it at all, if you're encouraged on your own, and so forth. Or a best case scenario, you've got a strategy for a comprehensive program. I'm going to go out on a limb and say there are going to be few respondents for that. And let's see, we've got 81% of everyone responding, Beth. So if you want, you can click on
sure.
close, I think it is, and then the results will show up on the screen for all of us.
That's great. I still see a few there. And I will now click close poll and hold my breath and hope that it shows the responses to everybody. So what I'm seeing.
Then is, click share.
Share.
Actually, I can do that. Wonder, I just did that.
You've got it. Oh, awesome.
Yeah, it turns out I can give you control of the screen, but I can even click the poll. So there we go.
Yeah, that's great. We can tag team it. That's great. So this is really interesting. This is somewhat typical of what I see. It varies depending on the audience I'm speaking with. So not discussed, a third of you. Hopefully we'll give you the tools to take that back to your workplace and initiate that discussion, whether it's everybody or whether it's just your team. Employees are encouraged to do it on their own. We kind of want to make that situation, move it to be more intentional. And then we have some folks that are in that there are periodic activities for wellness or well-being, which is great, but that could be sort of bumped up to more of a strategy. And then we have a small percent, 6%, where there is a comprehensive program. And I'm going to invite those people to come up and teach the webinar.
Exactly.
You know? Well, or in all seriousness, probably to share what their learning is in the questions and chat as we go. Well, great. So, Brian, I'm hearing a slight echo.
An echo of your voice?
I'm not quite sure, but I think it stopped. It stopped.
I'm not hearing it here. If other attendees are hearing it, let us know in the questions box. Otherwise, I think you might be okay.
Okay, good. I'm going to go on. Great. All right. So this is what we're going to cover today. I'm going to take you through understanding burnout, how to create a self-care plan, what's involved in terms of habit change so you can begin to practice self-care. It is all about, you know, establishing good habits. And then we're going to shift to the workplace lens and talk about how you activate a culture of well-being. I'm going to give you some examples and frameworks for getting started. I know there's always a question, and probably you've already answered this in the chat, but I've put slides, bonus materials, can all be found at that URL, and that will be sent out to you tomorrow. So to begin with, I always start with, you know, people ask me, you know, Beth, you know, you're known for digital strategy and networks and crowdfunding and, you know, how did you get into the self-care stuff? So I want to share a little bit about my own particular journey on this topic. So not too long ago, you know, before I started writing the book, I went in to see my doctor for that annual checkup where you get all those numbers like, you know, cholesterol, blood pressure, you know, all those good numbers, and my cholesterol numbers came back at 399 for triglycerides. And if you know anything about those biometrics, the healthy range is 150 or less. So obviously I was eating too many bacon cheeseburgers. This was my form of exercise. My thumbs got a really good workout while I sat on the couch and zoned out to TV. You know, maybe tequila was involved, but I'm not going to talk about that. And I think most of it had to do with me doing too much of this, which was burning my candle at both ends, if you will, working nights and weekends, sleep deprivation. I'll answer that last email, you know, at 11 o'clock at night. I'll sleep when I'm dead. And then no vacation and not even like giving myself permission to leave my desk to like just stretch or, you know, do something. So I went to see my doctor, and my doctor said to me, Beth, you know, if you just maybe started doing some walking every day, that would really help to use the word your biometrics. So I strapped on a Fitbit. I don't know how many of you have Fitbits. And I started walking, and it was really pitiful at first. It's kind of embarrassing, maybe 1,000 steps, 2,000 steps. But a Fitbit tracks it, and I was able to actually start to up it a little bit at a time to get up to about, you know, 15,000, sometimes 20,000 steps per day. And part of that is, if you have a Fitbit, you know this, they have this thing called leaderboards, so you can actually do challenges with your friends and colleagues. So you can see the little leaderboard icon, and I'm number 3 on the leaderboard. I'm walking against other fundraisers and people I know, and it's midnight, and I'm walking around our living room, and my husband's saying to me, what are you doing? And I'm saying, I'm number 3 on the leaderboard. I can't lose. So who knew I was so competitive? So after a little bit, I went back to my doctor and I had my test done and my results came down to the normal range. But something else happened. I started to feel better. Even though I was working less, spending a little bit more time walking, my brain was clearer. I was getting stuff done. You know, I was writing, cranking out those reports. I wasn't writing the same sentence 20 times. I wasn't procrastinating. My kids were telling me mommy's less grumpy. And so I got really excited about this notion of taking care of yourself as part of doing your nonprofit work, because it helps you do better work. So when I went to my colleagues and I was telling them, oh, you got to start walking, you got to take breaks, you got to take care of yourself, and it'll help you do better work. And I got this kind of response, you know, where do you find the time in your workday? And so this is the point, is that it's a mind shift change. We really need to reframe taking care of ourselves to help us do a better job at work, help us be more productive. So along with Aliza Sherman, my wonderful co-author, we start to dig into the research about, you know, productivity and self-care. So one of the first studies I came across was the study from Stanford, which is just down the road from me in California, that, you know, walking improves team creativity. And who doesn't want their fundraising team to be more creative? I mean, you have to be kind of creative, right, Brian, with doing the asks and coming up with ideas? You can't have brain freeze. So walking meetings helps with that. Another study that I came across was from Dr. Chuck Hillman from University of Illinois. And he was actually scanning people's brains. And the one that's on to my left is a brain that's been sitting quietly for 20 minutes. And what do you notice about it? It's like dark, right? It's grumpy. It's typing the same sentence on that grant proposal 20 times and not getting past it. The one on the right is a brain scan of a person that's gone out for a walk for 20 minutes. And if you look at it, you'll notice that it's all lit up. The synapses are firing, right? Those ideas are coming. So you have to ask, you know, what brain do you want to bring to your nonprofit fundraising work? The one on the left that's dark and a little grumpy and procrastinating, or the one on the right that's lit up and full of ideas and is just excited about the fundraising work and the work that the organization's doing. So, and that was a rhetorical question, but what brain do you want to bring to your work, Brian?
Yeah, exactly. I'm going out to walk right after this. I'm already convinced.
Me too. So a little bit after that, I went to a convening for the leadership learning community, and they were bringing together funders and social change, social justice movements. And I happened to meet the New York head of Black Lives Matter, and that's Alan Kawabina Frumpong, if I'm pronouncing his name correctly. And he told me this story, and this, again, bear in mind, this is August of 2015. It's the height of Ferguson. It's the height of the work that Black Lives Matter was doing around racial equity, if you remember, a lot of the protesting that was happening in St. Louis. And what they were doing at their meetings is they did a check-in. You know, everyone, you know, maybe you do that at your team meetings. Everyone go around and say how they're doing. And everyone was saying, like, they were frustrated, they were angry, stressed. And Alan said to them, you know, why are we doing this work? And so they realized that they needed to start to practice self-care as part of doing the work. And of course, they don't have a lot of money. It's not a big organization. And what they did is they became each other's accountability buddies in drafting their self-care plans. And someone would say, hey, I'm going to, you know, spend time with family over the weekend. I'm going to, you know, sleep in, get enough sleep. Somebody else said, I'm going to go get a massage. And I got a 20% off coupon. Anyone else want it? So from that, I took away this idea that, you know, it's not just about self-care, but it's also we care, because we're at work at so much and we have to sort of activate this culture of well-being as we do the work. So those are the themes that are in the book. It's part manifesto for mindset change. It's practical information about how you practice self-care. How do you recognize burnout? And then another part about bringing it into your workplace culture and the way you do the work. So let's look at the big picture and ask the question, why is burnout so common in the nonprofit sector, especially for fundraisers? All right. So I think this cartoon says it all to me. You can see an executive director, or maybe he's the head of fundraising. You know, he's had a few chest pains. He went into the ER. The doctor is leaning over him and he's whispering, grant deadline on Thursday. And so we're so passionate in this sector and we're so willing to do all of this work that we don't stop to smell the proverbial roses and really take care of ourselves. And as part of writing this book, we did interviews with hundreds of nonprofit professionals and we heard their burnout stories. In fact, I think I got PTSD from hearing some of it. People's hair falling out, people ending up in the hospital, having anxiety attacks. And somebody at one point said, why is it that we have to get sick before we start to take care of ourselves? So part of this happens for a couple of reasons. One is that we have the scarcity mentality in the nonprofit sector. We don't have enough staples in our stapler, so we're going to work extra hours to compensate. Or else, because we're so passionate about the work we do, we don't want to stop, or we feel everything is dependent on us. And lastly, we might have toxic work expectations, a toxic work environment and toxic expectations. And I think this happens a lot with fundraisers. Maybe everyone else sees the fundraisers, the development officers walk in and they just say, oh, okay, they're going to bring in barrels of money. The board says that we don't have to do anything. And as we know, as fundraisers, that, you know, it requires like everybody working on philanthropy. It's not just the fundraising department or the fundraisers. So that's a couple of big picture reasons why burnout is so prevalent. Let's actually look at burnout itself. So this is the clinical definition of burnout. And I'll read it. Burnout is a state of emotional, mental, and physical exhaustion that occurs when we feel overwhelmed by too many demands, too few resources, and too little recovery time. So, and so the important thing is to understand what the symptoms are of burnout. So they're really a constellation of symptoms that are around physical and emotional exhaustion, actual physical symptoms, feeling sick, feeling achy, signs of detachment and isolation, and then finally a lack of productivity and performance. And the problem with burnout is that it's really sneaky. It sneaks up on us, and before we know it, we're burned out. And so one of the things that we looked at was how can we educate ourselves around burnout so we can bounce back from it and prevent it? So we created this assessment, and there's a copy in the burnout in the bonus materials, not the burnout materials, but there's a copy of this assessment in the bonus materials. And right there, if you want that URL. And it's really a set of questions that relate to the symptoms. And then you check off whether you're experiencing this symptom, its frequency. And then you get an overall score and you land up in one of these four categories. And the purpose of it, it's not medical advice by any stretch of the means. I'm not a doctor and I don't play one on TV. But it's really to help educate you about, am I feeling the symptoms of burnout? Now, the steps to burnout, the stages, happen something like this. And what happens is that we're passion driven in the beginning when we start. We can work those nights and weekends. We feel great. We're inspired. We keep on working really hard. And if we don't practice self-care, we might get to that next stage, which is passion waning. And at that point, well, maybe we hit the snooze button when we set the alarm for early on Saturday morning to get up and do a little work at the office. And but we're able to do it. We get through it. Then if we don't practice self-care, we get to that third level, which is passion challenge. And here we might be catching a cold or feel achy or maybe feel a little anxiety or find it difficult to turn off thinking about work, even when we're supposed to be, you know, on our off hours or date night or whatever. And if we don't practice self-care, we get to that last stage, which is passion depleted, which means you're burned out, you're really cynical, you may even be depressed, you don't care. And at this point, you're not good to yourself, to your team, to your organization, or to the people that you are raising money for your organization's programs to serve. So, and the point is here is that you don't want to get up to that red stage because it takes longer to bounce back. So this is the first step is to sort of recognize whether or not you are experiencing the symptoms of burnout. And then the next step from there is to understand what some of your triggers are for stress in the workplace. Start to pinpoint them. And we'll talk a little bit of, about that in a moment. Another way to kind of look at this is what I call understanding your personal chaos index. And what this is, I call it PCI for short, and it comes from the drug addiction literature of all places by a psychologist named Peter Carnes. And a personal chaos index happens when you're addicted to something, whether it be drugs or your work or whatever, and you lose sight of everything else in the world, okay? Or you're just focused on that one thing. And so, and then certain behaviors start to manifest themselves. So for me, my personal chaos index is when there are dirty dishes in the sink, all right? And sadly, those are my dirty dishes. And why it's my PCI is because I, no matter how busy I am, every morning I like to make sure that my sink is really clean and the dishes I've been put in the dishwasher are put away and I'm starting with a clean slate. It makes me feel good. But if I walk in and I see this, I know that my personal chaos index is out of whack because I'm telling myself I'm too busy to do the dishes. So take a moment for yourself and think about what is your personal chaos index? You know, is it laundry? Is it a messy desk at work? It could also be things like behaviors like forgetting things like you or making careless mistakes like putting a calendar invite in the wrong date, showing up at a meeting and not bringing the materials you had prepared, leaving the house without your phone charger or your Metro card, you know, mixing up dates. So think about it. Brian, do you have one, a personal chaos index? that you can share?
I can. Well, I have a little minor OCD. It doesn't stop me from getting out of the house, but my things need to be sort of neat and lined up. My bed is always made with the decorative pillows on it as well, very neatly. And the chairs, I'm in an apartment and I have two chairs around a little dining table and two high bar stools, and they always have to, and those need to be neat and aligned. Those are my big things.
Yeah, so, you know,
they're like your sink.
Yeah, but you know, and there is actually a study about that says that if you make your bed first thing in the morning, it sets you off with a feeling of accomplishment and makes you feel productive. And I've gone through periods where I have tried that and it's worked for me, but for me, it's the dishes.
Yeah, so, I think you're going to touch on this, but just so you know, I just got a very interesting question from Matthew, which is there any way back from being red zone burnt out?
So there is, but it takes longer to bounce back.
And it's better to not get there.
Better not to get there, but if you are there, don't like freak out about it. But you also want to, if you hopefully you have health insurance or access to it, you know, get a medical checkup also, you know, and try to stop. There's a saying called, we're too busy chasing cows to build the fences. And we can get into this mode when we're just overwhelmed and we're so busy and we're burnt out. We feel like we can't take that time off. I've been there. But it will really help you if you stop, hit the pause button, try to like cancel out on some meetings, try to like get that day off and, you know, reconvene, reboot, reflect on like what's coming up, you know, are you saying yes to too many things? If your symptoms are physical illness symptoms, maybe it's time to, you know, take that day off and, you know, go check in with your doctor. But yes, you can bounce back. It just takes a little bit longer.
Great. Thanks.
All right. So enough about burnout. It's very cathartic when I do workshops and face-to-face and I do staff retreats with nonprofits. We can spend a lot of time, you know, talking about burnout. But we also have to talk about solutions. So the antidote to burnout is self-care. So self-care, if you read through the literature about self-care, the big metaphor that comes up is, you know, what the flight attendants tell you when you get on the airplane, put your oxygen mask on before helping others. So with self-care, there's many ways to put on the oxygen mask. And but it's important to think about what the definition of self-care is. So self-care is really about revitalization and includes any deliberate and consistent habits you create to enhance your overall well-being. And so it's not just about physical health, although health, that's a really important foundation. It's really much broader. So when I think about self-care and well-being in the workplace, I think about it in these five different areas. And these are all relationships. So your relationship with yourself, okay? And that's everything from your health to your self-talk, if you will, to being mindful, healthy eating, exercise, some things that we're going to talk about in a moment. Your relationship with other people. And some relationships give us a lot of energy, and other relationships can be energy vampires, if you will, or just be really unhealthy. Some of those relationships are our personal or family relationships, and others are, you know, in the workplace. So we need to have the tools to manage those relationships effectively, whether it's setting up boundaries or whether, you know, for personal relationships, or whether it is learning certain skills like managing up, managing down, and managing sideways, or learning how to say no. So that's that area, relationship with others. The other is the environment, and this is both our physical environment. What does our office look like? Is it noisy? Is it chaotic? Is it clean? Is it calming? Do we have fluorescent lights that give everybody a headache? Are there odors? Are there no windows? You know, is it a please aesthetically, you know, calming environment or not? And also getting outside, getting a chance to take a walk. Both Brian and I are going to go out for walks after this webinar, but making sure that, you know, you don't have, we work 8 hours a day, but we don't have to be chained inside for that entire 8 hours. Work and money, our relationship with work, our relationships at work and money. And then finally, our relationship with technology. There's a lot we don't know about our kind of always on lifestyle and use of mobile phones. And, you know, we really rely on the internet to get a lot of our work done. And we're spending a lot of time interacting with technology and people through technology. What is that doing to us? How is that causing stress? And how do we mitigate that? So these are all of the areas that would go in your self-care plan. So I'm going to take a breath and see if there's any questions before we move on to the next part.
Yeah. So Beth, here's a question. What's the most important self-care habit to start with? I mean, is there one? I mean, where on this diagram?
Okay, self, and in fact, I'm going to actually just, you're a perfect, what is it, straight man for me? what's the term?
Foil, right.
You just set me up for the next section of content. So what I'm going to do is summarize some of the research and best practices in practicing self-care and like where you should get started. So the place that where you should, if I would start anywhere, I would start with getting enough sleep, protect your sleep. All right. You know, sleep deprivation, skimping on our needed sleep does not let us perform and do our best for our organizations. Okay. So what happens when you don't get enough sleep? Well, it's you're cranky, right? You can't concentrate. And it's the equivalent of being what we call cognitively impaired. Another word for that is like drunk. Do you want to show up drunk to work? Well, maybe you do, but you're not going to perform your best. So it's important to start with, you know, getting the recommended nightly hours of sleep. And according to the National Sleep Foundation, they recommend that adults between over 18 to 65 need between 7 and 9 hours of sleep per night. That varies. There are some of us who need way less. That's rare. But for the most part, humans between those ages need between 7 and 9 hours of sleep per night. So for me, my Fitbit measures like the quantity of sleep, and it does give you sleep quality, with a grain of salt, you take that. So when I realized that, I started to try to aim for my 7 to 9 hours of sleep, and then kind of assess the next day how well I was performing. And I found for myself, I needed about 7.5 hours of sleep to really perform. So when I started thinking about that, I realized I had to change my bedtime routine. No more answering emails, at bedtime, and for that matter, I had to actually, I had to stop it. And here's why, is that that tiny little screen, that iPhone 6, has something, the amount of light, which is measured in kelvins, is 7,100 kelvins. A direct sunlight, sunny day, is 5,500 kelvins. So if you're looking at your little tiny screen in your bed before you're going to bed, that's telling your brain, wake up. It's the morning. It's like drinking a cup of coffee. And what that's doing is it disrupts your circadian rhythms, and it's robbing you of a good night's sleep. So what you need to do is to think about changing your bedtime routine. Okay. So think about creating a calm bedtime routine. You know, when you're a kid, or if you have kids, we give them a bedtime story and a bath. Find, maybe have a cup of tea, or, go back to reading novels. What a novel idea. And what I did for myself is I bought myself a really cool alarm clock called the Moonlight, and it wakes me up to light. I kick my iPhone out of the bedroom. And I also tried to stop using it after 7 p.m. at night, and also switch it to something called Night Shift, which dims the amount of kelvins. Or the amount of brightness, so it's not disrupting your sleep. It's not scientifically proven whether or not it works, but I'm trying a bunch of things to make sure that I can protect my sleep. All right. So the next thing is we sit too much. And perhaps you've heard this phrase, sitting is the new smoking. And that was developed by James Levine, who is the head of obesity research at the Mayo Clinic at the University of Arizona. And he's the inventor of the treadmill desk. And he's done lots of different studies about the connection between the amount of time we're sitting at our desks and various diseases, from heart disease to bad back to brain fog. And if you're thinking, oh, well, I go to the gym, this is not going to impact me. Yes, it is. It's the amount of time that we're sedentary, sitting. and if it's more than like an hour and a half or so at a time, that's what's causing the illnesses and the problems. So we need to start standing more at work and taking standing breaks. And what I hear from nonprofits is the standing desk is too expensive, or we can't afford it. And so here's an example of a nonprofit that hacked one from a music stand and a carton. So you'll see that resource there. There's lots of standing desks. Some of them are expensive. There's some fancy expensive ones, or you could hack one. Here's another example. This is, I noticed that there were some folks from Canada. I think somebody from Moose Jaw, Canada. So in Canada, they have a national program called Kick the Sit Out of Your Work Habits, and you can get this very low cost cardboard desk. And you can see it's kind of sturdy and handles all those textbooks. And a number of Canadian NGOs have these in their offices. It's kind of like the communal standing desk, and it wasn't that expensive. And here's another example from a music organization. They're using a grand piano. The most important thing with standing desks is that you want to make sure that they're ergonomically correct, or you're going to cause more problems than solving. You might want to get a foot pad because your feet get sore, and you don't want to start standing up 8 hours a day right off the bat. You want to kind of ease into it, kind of think about what activities you can do best standing, what works best for sitting. I know for me, I mean, I'm standing right now because I like to present standing. But when I'm writing, I like to sit. So I try to organize my work time to also think about when I'm going to sit and when I'm going to stand. And then I'm, taking sitting breaks from standing. So I'm not on my butt too long and causing health problems. The other important thing is to walk more. All right. And now, how many of you are using your computer keyboards as a lunch tray? All right. Now, that used to be what my desk looked like. I don't eat Doritos anymore. or for that matter, peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. But I do, what I do is I get up and I walk at lunch, and it helps with the afternoon slump. And it, I get, I'm a much more productive afternoon. So we'll talk a bit in the next section about like creating the culture for it to be okay to get up from your desk. You are allowed a lunch hour. And I guarantee you, even if you take half of it or 20 minutes just to do a walk, you'll come back refreshed. But when you're out on your walk, don't take your mobile phone with you, all right? How many of you know about distracted walking? That's, you know, people walking and looking down and on their mobile phone. And according to the Pew Internet and American Life interview, there's been a 35% increase in pedestrian accidents due to distracted walking. The other problem that it can cause is something called text neck. And text neck is happens because your neck is bent over and you're on your phone and your neck, your head weighs something like 20, 25 pounds. And humans were designed to be erect and tall, not bent over. And that's putting a lot of pressure on your neck muscles. So you'll start to feel some pains in your neck, or otherwise known as text neck. So don't take your mobile phone with you, and it's important to take those breaks. One of the contributors of stress is that we don't have any downtime. And this comes from a Lou Harris poll. 52% of smartphone owners check their phones a few times an hour or more. And I think it was 25% check them in the bathroom. This is behavioral addiction, all right? And so I thought when I saw that data, well, that's not me. Okay, I, you know, I'm not addicted. And then I downloaded this program called Moments, and it gave me a report of, you know, how many times I picked up my phone and how much time I'm spending on my phone throughout the week. And it was kind of embarrassing there. 30 pickups per day, 210 pickups per week, 2.5 hours per day on the phone, 17 hours per week. And the thing is that I looked the next report, which I'm not going to show you. It gave me a breakdown of what percentage of my time I was spending on different apps. And it wasn't all work. It wasn't all contributing to my productivity. And then one thing is you don't blame yourself because in Silicon Valley, their interface designers are designing it so we get addicted. Now, they use something called the ludic loop. And the ludic loop is goes something like this. A ludic loop is when you get sucked into a repetitive activity because every once in a while you get a reward. Sound like a slot machine? So that's what's happening when we pick up our phones or when we check our email or we check Facebook. And in fact, Larry Rosen, who is one of the key researchers, he's here in California. He wrote a book called iBrain, where they actually hooked up EKG monitoring on people's brains while they were using different technologies. And what they found is that when the urge to check your email or to check Facebook or to check CNN or whatever it is comes from within, it's a thought that happens. And that thought then releases cortisol, which is the stress hormone, and that makes us feel stress. And the only way that we can relieve that anxiety is to go pick up our phones and, you know, check our email. And then we get caught in this ludic loop. So the solution to this is to kind of break the cycle and take control of your mobile device. And these are a couple of tips that have come from a site called Human Tech, which is Tristan Harris, who is a former interface designer at Google, one of those interface designers who was designing for people to be addicted. And he's spoken out against it and is creating this movement and a lot of awareness around, you know, this behavioral addiction to our phones. So these are a set of tips. There's more at that URL, which you'll find in the bonus materials. But I just want to mention a couple of my favorite tips. One of them is to remove all of the notifications except from people. So turn all the automatic notifications from apps off. You don't need those. You don't need that bell ringing. That's teaching you to be distracted. The other thing you might want to do is think about Gboard, which is Google's keyboard product that you can use for on the iPhone or other platforms. And what it does, it has really good predictive text and it allows you to do things with less keystrokes so you can get on your phone and get off. which I really like. The other thing that I do quite frequently is scramble my apps because our thumbs have memory. There's something called thumb memory, okay? And you could be out on date night with your significant other, and then you're going to get the urge to check the phone, and then your thumbs are going to remember where your work email is and where your calendar is or where Facebook is. And then all of a sudden, you know, you're going to be back at work and not at date night. So what I do is I scramble my apps so my thumbs, so it gives my thumbs have to do a walk of shame, like, what am I doing? Why am I checking my email at midnight on a Friday? I don't need to do that. The other thing I also like to do is use an app called Forest. And Forest helps you break that addiction to being on your phone a lot. So what it does is, like, you plant a tree and you set a timer. So it says for 30 minutes, I'm not going to touch my phone, and it does a timer countdown. And if you pick up the phone and touch it, the tree dies. But if you don't touch your phone and then you go off and you're focused for 30 minutes and you do your work, the app will send money to a forest conservation organization that will plant a tree in your honor. So there are a whole lot more ways to take control of your mobile phone, but these are just a few. So get control of your mobile phone. The other thing is, a lot of us, depending on, you know, what you're working on and what your role is, we've had an addiction to breaking news. Oh my God, what's going to happen now? What happened now? What do they do now? And those alerts and that kind of constant, oh my God, breaking news can cause a lot of stress. So a lot of nonprofit, even communications people, are putting themselves on a news diet. And that means they're consuming news at a specified time and specified sources during the day. And while they're consuming it, they're doing a news meditation, is that they're being present when consuming it and understanding what the impact is, and trying not to read every single thing on the topic, but reading only the things that are most relevant to work. Also removing notifications, and also now and then taking a break from Facebook, because sometimes, you know, getting on, and I'm a social media person and I do take breaks, hearing and seeing your friends talking about something can sort of make it feel like it's more of an emergency than it is. So going on a news diet. Another important thing is to be scheduling quiet time. There are lots of studies that show, you know, being in back-to-back meetings and then doing email in between, that wreaks havoc on your nervous system. And you need to have those quiet focus times to really reboot it. Now, if you look at this, I love this. This was making the rounds on Facebook. I don't think you have to go to these lengths, but there's a sign there that says, do not disturb, I'm on a tight schedule today. Exceptions in case of emergency are permitted. Am I on fire and don't know it? Are you on fire and I'm the only one who can put you out? Are you a pizza? The zombie apocalypse is here. So what you can do really is maybe block out quiet time. You know, sometimes I schedule meetings just with myself so I'm not available for meetings, you know. There's lots of ways. And we'll talk about this in a moment, even have team-wide quiet days or stop days when there are no meetings scheduled, where people get work done. Lots of ways that you can do this, but it's really important to have that quiet time.
Beth?
Yes?
Question.
Sure.
Well, first of all, I have to tell you, this is making a big impact on me. I'll admit I am multitasking. As a matter of fact, someone who is at Kathy said, so you're suggesting I shouldn't be doing 17 other tasks while listening to this webinar?
Absolutely. Yes.
I'm sure many of us are. I did take your assessment. I'm in a much higher zone than I'd like to be. I have a standing desk, which I wasn't using. I am now standing. So I am really absorbing a lot of this, but I do have a question. So in this work environment, I'm sure many listening today are in some sort of work environment like that, because most of the people on today are fundraisers. Where do you start the discussion at your workplace, either with your fundraising team or with your ED, if it needs to be something office-wide or organization-wide? What do you do? What's the best approach? Because someone needs to bring it up. As we know from the survey, virtually no one's got a real strategy. Some have some periodic activities, but a periodic activity isn't enough. So
What we're really
Yeah, what do you
talking
do?
about is creating norms for the way we work, and we have to start with small steps, okay? We place so much emphasis on getting results, which are important and high performance. We don't pay enough attention to the way that we do the work. So this could be, you know, one thing you could do, and there's links to this on the site and certainly in my book, is to look at the research literature on the connection between productivity and the amount of hours you're working and the amount of back-to-back meetings. There's something called collaborative overload, which is too many back-to-back meetings. That's not an effective way to work. So maybe it's initiating a discussion around that and coming up with some norms around when there might be stop days or quiet times where there's, you know, no meetings. We're not going to even talk to each other. Or acknowledging the fact that people do need to have some time in their schedule where they are working on solo tasks to work on deliverables and honoring that. And then it's like once you've stated that you're going to do that, it's checking in around it.
So this is interesting. We're getting a lot of feedback here, and with all the people on, we won't get to everything, but this we've obviously touched on a subject here that's really important to us in the nonprofit world, to us fundraisers. So actually one person acknowledged that she was standing twice, then went back to multitasking, but said, this was Diana, that she used to put a ribbon across her workstation entrance with a do not disturb sign and was amazed at how few people honored it. And then Elise at the same time chimed in, any tips for those of us who are sharing offices or don't even consistently have a workspace? Because, you know, then now there's all this, you know, you check in and you find a place at larger nonprofits, and how, so that must be making this situation even more fraught.
It is. Again, it's really about being explicit about work norms and about having quiet place. I know Global Giving actually has a quiet area and for check-in staff, and it's, you know, no talking in that area. And if and it's okay to go there and use it. They have an open workspace, but if you need to focus, then you're able to go into that space. As a matter of fact, what I think I'm going to do actually, because I'm looking at the time, let me jump into the section of the presentation that looks at that. I'm going to put this right here. So this is Global Giving, and they have an open office space. You can see the one guy there, sort of in the middle, standing and talking to the other guy. And there's somebody in the front that's kind of on the left, and you can see his headset's on. He's trying to concentrate and get work done. An open workspace is great for collaboration, but it can also be noisy and chaotic. So what Global Giving did, and they're in Washington, D.C., is that they have this quiet zone area, and that's also where they have their standing desks. And they made it okay for people to go there. It's okay. You can use the space if it, you know, it's the library space. It's quiet space. Can't use your cell phone here, but this is where if you need quiet time, you can go. What they also did is they had explicit conversations around that. You know, what is it in the way that we do work? How do we respect each other's need to be quiet or work or focus? So they, you know, have these things and these signs are on the wall, like, you know, interruptions happen, but read body language first. You know, be if someone has headphones on, you know, assume that they're in the zone. You know, be thoughtful about which conversations you jump into or the volume of your voice. And so these are all along the wall. As sort of as reminders, and they do those check-ins, if you will, about you know about like how are we doing in terms of our open office space and giving each other the ability to, you know, concentrate and focus. So it's not something where you just flick the light switch and it happens. It's culture, and you have to work on it.
Yeah, and that's right. We're getting so many comments. Like Sandra's saying, she actually said, I'm on a webinar. She has a sign. She has her headphones on. People are still interrupting her. You know, so many nonprofits are really small. The first three I worked for, we all sat in one room. Right? Now that was 30 years ago, and we didn't have phones, and there were less other disruptions, but still, we were in that situation. I know many are in it today. It has me thinking. Especially for nonprofits where our office spaces are often subpar to begin with, that this is an even greater challenge for us, and
Yeah,
that we really need to advocate for it. So,
let me
yes.
share another story of that. And then this is a small, somewhat small. This is the Philanthropy University. They're in Berkeley. And so you can see there's like six people on their team. It's a relatively small organization. It's not teeny tiny with one person or two people, but you know, five or six, and they're all in one room, except for they do have a conference room. And so I did a lunch and learn with them about just on this problem, right? And one of their problem was a different variation of this. Not so much the interruptions, but they had everybody was on their devices during meetings and multitasking. You know, do your meetings look like this? And so what they started to do, and I think it's a really interesting approach, is that they had quarterly kind of culture questions to focus on a different pain point. So for this one, they were because of that pain point, they were focusing on questions around mindfulness. And so the question was, what behaviors, norms, and processes can we establish to engender more mindfulness and presence in our interactions? And so one of the things they came up with was they transformed this whole food bags into their digital detox box. So when they did go in the conference room for meetings and they didn't need the technology to support the meeting, that they were going to give each other their full attention. and they said that, and they also established meeting norms for the use of technology. So, you know, we will not multitask during the meeting. We will not use our devices unless we're getting information to support the meeting. And these bullet points, there were just a handful, you know, two, three, four, were on the top of every meeting agenda. And they spent 5 minutes at the beginning of the meeting saying, okay, these are the norms around use of technology. All right. And then at the end of the meeting for a few minutes, they say, well, how well did we do? So you can do this with any kind of pain point when you're trying to like shift the culture into a new way of working. And it takes, you know, a little bit of discipline to do it and continual working on it. So for the interruption thing, some organizations set up, you know, one organization uses teddy bears and they put them outside the doors because they do have, some of the offices have doors on them and it's like, do not interrupt. If the teddy bear is out there, if the teddy bear is not there, it's, you know, you can come in, and they've discussed it, like the teddy bear, what it means. There's some that use signage. There's some actually signage is things that you can buy on Amazon that says in a phone call, do not disturb, you know, or open door, come in and chat. And then also talking about, there's an exercise, and actually I'll put a link to it, that you could go through with everybody on your team. Small organization can do it with everybody, called what's your owner's manual, okay? What is it, what's the best way that you work? And do you welcome interruptions? If people interrupt you, do you want it on Slack? Do you want it on chat? Do you want an email? Do you want someone to call you? Do you want someone to schedule an appointment and come in, you know, and do it during your one-to-one catch up, you know? So everybody kind of writes out their owner's manuals and people get to share the ways that they work best, and then you work on kind of honoring those. So it's a matter of, like, I think formalizing some of these ways of working.
Great.
Let's see. I jumped around a bit. Any other? Let's shift into some of the questions, maybe. I will say, actually, I'll do one easy way to get started with, you know, initiating the conversation is to, one way to do it is to have, is to bring those self-care assessments and have people create their plans together, set up accountability buddies, and have people start to make small changes and have that discussion around, okay, so these are some things we're going to do for ourselves around self-care. What are some things we can bring into the workplace? And they don't have to be expensive. We're not talking about bringing in organic, expensive catered food or sending everybody to the day spa or whatever. All those things are nice, but you know, we're just talking about simple things like it's okay to take your lunch hour and go out for a 20-minute walk, you know, making some of the norms explicit that to bring we care into the workplace. I also have another exercise that you can do as a team, and I'm going to pop back to that. It's also on the bonus materials. It's called the 5 F's. And this is a framework about, well, you know, the culture of well-being in the workplace. And you have, and you can do this with your development team, or you can do it with all staff. And you're just doing like a sticky note brainstorm, and you're asking these questions related to functioning. Do people have what they need to do their job? Feelings, do people feel appreciated and respected? Friendship, do people feel connected to one another? Forward, do people have opportunities for growth? And fulfillment, do people feel like they're inspired and working towards a higher purpose? So you have this discussion, you have a brainstorm, and then you pick a couple of easy wins, you know, like for example, one organization felt like, you know, people don't feel really connected. What if we had like once a month, we did a potluck and we just ate a meal together, you know, everybody brought something in for lunch and we just, you know, got to know each other. Another thing, what if we recognized, you know, different people for doing some great work? This one organization, Common Sense, which is in San Francisco, they do an annual thing called Surpraise. So once a month, they pick an employee who's done an extraordinary job, and everybody covers their desk with sticky notes of praises, and they put flowers on and give them some chocolate. So things like that, that don't have to be expensive or time consuming, but they can create a friendlier atmosphere at work. So any other questions that coming
well,
up?
There are many, and there are a couple with a similar theme. So I'd like to pose those. And I think, but not surprisingly, a number of people who were drawn to this are really concerned about their health and the health of their nonprofits. And so we're getting some questions about, you know, What if you're really burnt out and you need to ask for some stress time off? Or that was one question. And the other was, you know, this woman asked, am I in the minority in feeling that there's a stigma around burnout, that talking about it to a boss feels like expressing a vulnerability, weakness? So, you know, we're talking about people who, you know, are pushing against that limit and really needing to repair their well-being.
Right. Well, yes. Yeah. I mean, in some workplaces, yes, there's a stigma against it. And then we have self-care abusers. Mm-hmm. And that's like, or self-care self-sabotagers where, oh my God, okay. I'm not going to that fundraising event tonight because self-care, and that happens when it's not discussed as a team, as an organizational priority, then people pit their self-care needs against each other, and that doesn't work. So you need the organizational conversation. In some workplaces, they actually have it in the handbook that people have, especially stressful kinds of work where they're suicide prevention lines or mm-hmm. you know, where they're working with vulnerable populations or disaster relief, where they actually have to have a self-care plan in place, and yes. they're given time off and making sure that people take their vacation time, that they're not burning the midnight oil. So I think that, you know, initiating the conversation about needing to like step back, get some time off, personal time off. I mean, take a look if, you know, have you taken your vacation time? Are you sacrificing your vacation? You know, what is the policy around vacation? Is it, you know, you get a certain amount of time, but they're not making sure you take it. It's also, I think, really important to talk about not just, hey, I'm burned out, I need this help, but also it's links, you know, the sense of well-being and taking care of yourself and how that links to productivity and how it really benefits the organization. It, you know, it helps them in a lot of different ways, like recruiting and retaining top talent, reducing healthcare costs, having people be prepared to get through those stressful times of the year, like you're in giving. If you are taking care of yourself, or if there is a culture of well-being, you're going to be able to handle those stressful times.
Right. We had someone say that their CEO, their favorite term is, you can sleep when you're dead.
Yeah, and you'll die sooner.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say, for those extreme situations, and I guess I've never been one to take too much abuse in the workplace. At a certain point, if I could, I'd leave. if it's really that toxic. And I'm not saying everyone has the opportunity to do that. There are many reasons why you have to stay at a job. But I also will say that one of the things I've always felt good about in the fundraising world, so I've been a fundraiser my entire career since college, is that we are in demand. There are a lot of jobs for fundraisers. And I would say if your boss or your organization has a bad culture, then you should consider another job because there probably is one out there. We're very lucky that way, that there are lots of fundraising jobs for better and for worse. We could spend hours on that, but the truth is that we have a lot more flexibility, I think, than other people in the nonprofit world. And we should take advantage of that because especially, right, we're having this webinar because fundraising is really difficult. You have to be on, you have to have a certain well-being to go out there and interface with these donors all the time, to pick up the phone, to send the email, to keep pushing through to get the appointments. And if you're not in a healthy environment, it's only going to make it more difficult. And when we talk about all these distractions, right, then it's all this time that you're not focused on who are my top 10 donors and what am I going to do with them this week, or who am I going to call in the next hour, because the windows now are 5 minutes.
Right.
So.
And what I'd say to that, so what I hear you saying is fundraisers, you're in demand. You have the upper hand. Don't feel like you're stuck. All right. So with that, have an exit. If it's so toxic, you have to leave. Create an exit strategy. Understand you have the upper hand. And when you're looking at your next job, don't just look at the salary. Yeah, look at the job task, but also look and notice the organization's culture, because that's going to be just as important as how much you're getting paid and the work you're doing.
And I think there is this tendency in our, we know there's this tendency in our field to be martyrs, or to make at times to push towards that limit because we're here to help, right? Okay, we're doing the important work. We want to make the world safer. We want children to be educated. We want people to be healed, whatever it is. And I think we're willing to take more because we're mission driven. We feel we should tough it out.
Right, that
And
only goes so far.
it only goes so far, right? And so many of us in this field are pushing those limits for all these reasons, and it makes it that much more important. I'm watching the time, Beth. We just passed our hour mark. I want to be respectful of everyone. So let me it would be great if you could stand a few more minutes. If there is enough, if you have another important point or two to add, great. Otherwise, maybe we'd have one more question.
I have actually have a conclusion. I'm just give a
Great,
big
let's do
summary
that.
takeaway for people.
That would
There's
be
a lot here
great.
in the deck. You're all doing really important work. Fundraising is incredibly important to the organization, and you're not there because you like raising money. Well, yeah, maybe yes, you do, but you're there because of the organization's mission and what it's doing to make the world a better place for people that it serves. And it's really important in order for your organization to sustain it, for you to sustain it, to practice self-care and to have a culture of well-being. So I'm hoping that you'll start practicing self-care and start the discussion at your nonprofit. And just a reminder that there's a lot of information in the book. There's a link there for where you can get it. You can get it on Amazon. My slides, the bonus resources that I mentioned are all up at that URL. I'm sure Brian will send that out. And
Yes.
I just want to thank everybody for spending this hour and being open to talk about this. Thank you.
Well, and Beth, thank you. This is such an important topic. I have to say, this has been a very important topic for me today, and I'm sure everyone listening is going to leave inspired, a little bit empowered to do more for themselves. And so I really appreciate your being here today, because to the extent we help ourselves, we fulfill our mission, right? It's easier for us to help others. So thank you so much, Beth. It's been great having you on today. And have a great
Thank you.
afternoon, everyone. And good luck with your fundraising. And I hope you're all getting a little time in August to rejuvenate. So take care, everyone. Bye-bye.